Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the International History Institute in the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston University. Our speaker is Harvard University PhD candidate Danny Orbach. Mr. Orbach's lecture is titled The Anti-Nazi Coups That Failed, 1938 and 1944. Did they have a chance? We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor William Keelor, Director of Boston University's International History Institute.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the International History Institute, and we're delighted to have with us today Mr. Danny Orbach, who has an extraordinary career already, even though he's still very young. He served for several years in the Israeli Army, the Israeli Defense Force, then received his bachelor's degree, summa cum laude, in Western History and East Asian Studies at Tel Aviv University. Afterwards, he studied for 2 years as a research student in Tokyo University, already having learned Japanese before he got there. And currently, he's a PhD student at Harvard University, working on a comparative history of military revolts and political assassinations in Japan, Germany, and elsewhere. And his current interest, among all these other interests that he has, is the German resistance to Hitler. He wrote his first book, Valkyrie, The German Resistance to Hitler, was published in Hebrew. He is going to today, share his knowledge about, I think, a very important subject, one that has great interest to all of us, and that is the attempts failed, sadly, to overthrow Hitler, first during the Munich Conference in 1938, and then, of course, the assassination attempt in 1944. And the title of his talk is The Anti-Nazi Coups That Failed, 1938 and 1944, did they have a chance? So, Danny Orbach.
Hello. We will speak and analyze today about two failed coup d'etat attempts made in Nazi Germany in 38 and 44 by a body or an organization called the German Resistance Movement. We will define this term more accurately a bit later. Well, the title is The Anti-Nazi Coups, Did They Have a Chance? Many, many books were written on the subject why the coups against Hitler did not have a chance from the beginning. This is a very common theme in historical writing on the subject. Why? Because the coups failed. And many historians tend to assume that everything that happened in a certain way had to happen, just like that, that it was inevitable. Well, I wouldn't take the opposite approach of counter-history today. What if the bomb would have put not under the table, but in the left side of the table? We are not going to do that today. What we are going to do instead is to try to find the structural problems that made the success chances of the coup lower at certain scenarios and under certain historical conditions. And we will try to get some insights from this story. So if any one of you will want to plan a coup d'etat in the future, better learn and listen. The famous British military writer Sir Basil Liddell-Hart differentiated between two approaches to strategy, the direct and the indirect approach. The direct approach is a full force attack on the center of gravity of your enemy. The indirect approach, as it may imply, is an approach which is avoiding the enemy's center of gravity, trying to subvert him from the sides. According to Liddell-Hart, guerrilla, by definition, must take the indirect approach because guerrilla is too weak to be engaged with the enemy directly. One of the things I would like to argue is that unlike guerrilla, which is fighting for liberation in an occupied territory, an underground, like the German resistance movement, which is fighting its own government, has to take the direct approach. Why? The indirect approach, for example, take the Polish underground during the Second World War. The Polish underground ambushed the Germans once in a while in smaller texts, built its own alternative education system, ideological system, actually a shadow government, and waited for the moment that the Germans will be weak enough in order to be engaged in a full-scale attack. But the Polish underground had a friendly nation around it. You can hide, attack the enemy once in a while, and hope to subvert him slowly when you know you have support from your periphery. But in the case of Nazi Germany, the resistors, as we will say in a moment, knew very well that the vast majority of the people supports the regime. They knew very well that if they will win, Germany may be occupied by a foreign army, not liberated. Therefore, the German resistance members, both in 38 and 44, and we'll speak about the difference between these two attempts in a moment, assumed that in order to get rid of the Nazi regime, one must destroy the regime's center of gravity, that is, Hitler himself. So the prerequisite for any successful coup d'etat against the Nazi regime was the removal of Hitler, meaning a direct attack. How to do it? This was the main question that the German resistance movement grappled with from 38 to its end in 44. Hitler, as every student of World War II knows, used a very sophisticated trick in order to gain the loyalty of the army. Every soldier and officer had to swear an oath of allegiance personally to Hitler, not to Germany, not to the Nazi party, not even to the institution of the Führer. They may be another Führer, even in the Nazi system, to Hitler personally. That's why it was psychologically very difficult for officers to rebel against the regime as long as Hitler is alive. This was yet another important argument underlying the basic strategy of the German resistance to remove Hitler personally, first of all. I would like to very shortly do away with three myths which are very, very common in resistance historiography. There is a myth, what I call the myth of opportunism, that this were a group of Nazi officers who just wanted to save either themselves or Germany in the last moment. This is not supported by almost all of the evidence we have, both contemporary and post-war. Just two examples. When Stauffenberg, which we will speak about later, the military leader of the conspirators, devised his commands for the coup d'etat, one of the first commands he gave to his troops was to free the concentration camps. And we can see in many, many testimonies that the conspirators were troubled both by the defeat of Germany and its occupation. They wanted to save their homeland and they wanted to stop the crimes of the regime. I will not speak about it further because we are more concerned with the military issues today. The myth of belatedness, this is also very common. Again, very related to the first myth. Only in 44, when Germany's defeat was already on the horizon, only then did they try to topple the regime. Actually, it began in 38, 1 year before the war, and went on. There were attempts all during the war. There is another one which is more interesting, and you can see it once in a while, the myth of dilettantism. Some historians wrote that the assassination attempts were so badly carried out that it's almost unbelievable that professional officers could have done such mistakes. First of all, I'm always asking myself if these historians could do it better. That's one thing. Second of all, I would like to argue here that the conspirators, if at all, failed not because we were dilettantes, but because we were too professional. First of all, no one in no army that I know about once studied the art of coup d'etat in military academy or officer course. So any coup d'etat, especially in a country like Germany, which didn't have many coup d'etats before, is an uncharted territory. How much one should be professional in order to be successfully engaged in military coup d'etats, we'll speak about it a bit later. So we are coming to our first test case. The attempt to topple Hitler in September 1938, also called the September Conspiracy. These were the four people who established the German resistance in 1938. Most important, Colonel Hans Oster, number two in the German military intelligence, a man deeply shocked by the crimes of the regime already in the 1930s, which secretly, as a good intelligence officer would do, looked for other people who are discontent with the regime in order to develop, to start, build a military and civilian underground. One of them was Dr. Hans Gisevius, a Gestapo official who got virtually kicked out of the Gestapo because of personal fights with all sorts of people, finally with Himmler. And he was the main ally of Oster, kind of a middleman or a shadow person, which was keeping in touch between the two groups, between the various groups. Karl Gerdeler was the main civilian leader of the German resistance, the Lord Mayor of Leipzig, which resigned from his post in protest against the persecution of the Jews mainly, and General Erwin von Witzleben, the commander of Greater Berlin, a key person in this coup d'etat, as we'll see later, which mainly wanted to prevent World War II. He didn't know it would be a world war yet, but a war between Germany, Britain, and France, mainly. So we have four people with very different motives. This will go on in the German resistance. People had very, very different motives and ideas. They agreed about eliminating Hitler, but about little else. The idea of for the 1938 coup d'etat was to try to utilize the only thing that all of his people agreed about. The war must be stopped. Even people who were not anti-Nazi, like Oster, for example, or like Gerdeler, agreed that Germany had no chance against Britain and France. Many people in the high command believed it. And therefore, Oster tried to utilize this reason in order to start the coup d'etat. The plan was as follows. In autumn 1938, there was the Sudeten crisis. I won't speak about the detailed political reasons of the crisis and what happened inside, but mainly, Hitler was keen on attacking Czechoslovakia in order to get the Sudetenland. Britain and France threatened to take measures against it. And the general opinion in Germany at around September 38 was that Hitler is going to war with Britain and France without being prepared for such a war. Therefore, Oster succeeded to convince two key persons that this war must be prevented at all costs. One of them was Hilamer Schacht, the director of the Central Bank, a very, very dubious personality, but he was still a government minister, and he agreed to take the civilian administration, or to be the civilian leader after Hitler will be toppled. The most important person was this person, General Franz Halder, who was the chief of staff at the time. Halder, unlike Oster, was not an anti-Nazi in the full sense of the word. He was a person who mainly wanted to prevent a war. And he told Oster something like that. I'm giving you a mandate to play in a coup d'etat in one condition. Britain should stand firm against Hitler. If Britain will prove to me that we are going to go to war for the Sudetenland, I will support you in the coup d'etat. The plan was as follows. Halder should give the command to start immediately when Hitler will give the order to attack Czechoslovakia. Oster will give the command to his people. Heldorf and Nebe, two generals from the police, should surround the government ministries with policemen. Soldiers loyal to General Witzleben, the commander of Greater Berlin, should come to the capital and reinforce the policemen. And then special shock troops that Oster prepared, led by two young officers which were involved in right-wing terror groups during the 20s, Heinz and Liddig, should occupy the government ministries. Halder believed that they will arrest Hitler and bring him to trial. Actually, Oster's plan was, and he cooperated with Witzleben and the shock troops, to kill Hitler discreetly during the raid, just telling that he tried to escape in order to, again, get rid of the center of gravity of the regime. Now I want to, and there was another general who supported the conspiracy in Thuringen, Höppner, which should have probably blocked SS reinforcement from Munich. So we would speak about it a bit later. But I want you to see something interesting in this chart. You see these arrows down. This is what we may define as vertical dependency. Oster is being dependent in several people which would carry out his wish. But these people are members of the resistance. Of course, they may betray. They may refuse to obey orders. But they are, in a way, committed to Oster, ideologically. Main problem is with these two people. And this is what we should define as horizontal dependency. Namely, the conspiracy is dependent on two people, mainly Halder, which are not part of the group, are not committed to the group. They are more like allies. This was a very, very, very problematic element in this conspiracy. Horizontal dependencies are always dangerous because you can never know what the horizontal ally will do when the moment of truth will come. But it has advantages too. Halder, the main horizontal ally, was the chief of staff. As he was the chief of staff, the conspirators could use large parts of the German military machines to help them make the plans. We mentioned the shock troops, which were given weapons by the army. They were hidden in apartments inside Berlin. The most amazing thing, Gisevius, the middleman who made the plans, who drafted the plans, actually worked in the army high command. He was given an office. I don't know if it doesn't look strange to you that a conspirator is working in the army high command and is given an office. The argument was that he's working on Witzleben's family papers. So the horizontal alliance with Halder gave him permission to use the military machine on the one hand. On the other hand, it made them fully dependent on Halder's wish. This is just a map to show you how it should have been carried out. Witzleben is here in Berlin. Here, actually, the action should take place. Again, we say direct approach in the center of gravity, not in the provinces. Höppner is here in Thuringen. Here is an SS division, the Leibstandarte, which had probably tanks. And they were afraid that it will come to Berlin to take down the coup, and the job of Höppner was to block them and then probably to bring his forces up to Berlin in order to help the conspirators. Again, factors of horizontal dependency. We have Halder. Worse than that, we have Chamberlain. The coup was dependent, and that was Halder's condition from the start, that Britain and France will be firm against Hitler in the Sudeten crisis. And what happened to the conspiracy? When everything was ready, the shock troops were already in place, the conspiracy failed because Britain signed the Munich Agreement. So then both horizontal alliances collapsed. It's not that the conspirators just relied on the British. They sent emissaries to London to tell the British that there is going to be a coup d'etat. No one in Britain took them seriously, especially not Chamberlain. Some people did take them seriously, but they were not important enough. So when this horizontal alliance collapsed, this horizontal alliance collapsed as well. Now, Halder said after the war, this is Britain's fault. I was ready to cooperate. But we don't have time to speak about it in details, but in 39 and 40, the conspirators tried to repeat the same plan with some variations, again to convince Halder to give the order to stage the coup d'etat when something will happen in the front. For example, most generals believed that an attack against France doesn't have a lot of chance to succeed. Some were against it. Halder was against it too, and he was supposed to give the order to stage the coup d'etat again when Germany will attack France. He changed his mind in the last minute. And it happened at least 3 times. So this brought to the conspirators' mind the inherent weakness of this concept of horizontal alliance, to be dependent on the high command, to work in their offices, to try to get their cooperation, to try to beg them, to try to implore them. After France was occupied, and after Russia was invaded in 41, the conspirators, bit by bit, began to change their ideas and to rework their plans in order to get rid of horizontal alliances as much as possible, meaning to be dependent in themselves alone. So these are the people who actually brought the new conception. Mainly this General von Tresco, a very senior operations officer in Army Group Center in Russia, and General Friedrich Olbricht from the Reserve Army. These were young officers. They were not a serious part of the coup d'etat attempt in 1938, and they had new ideas. The main idea that these two people had is that the conspirators should assassinate Hitler first, and only then ask the generals for their help. Yeah, they should get alliances, they should speak with generals before, but they shouldn't get permission from anyone. To remind you, the attempt in 1938 failed mainly because Halder did not give his permission. This time, mainly Tresco was responsible to carry out the assassination attempts, convince the civilian leaders of the resistance that this time we will not take permission from anyone. First assassinate Hitler, then act. Actually, Oster, the chief architect of the coup d'etat in 1938, supported such a strategy from the beginning, but he was in minority. His strategy virtually won after 1931. Oster himself was kicked out in 1943 because he made a very complicated operation to rescue Jews out of Germany, and he was caught. Therefore, not only that Oster was placed in house arrest by the Nazis, but all the center of commanders around him collapsed as well. So the resistance in around 1943 had to restructure itself. Then they carried out a second serious attempt. General von Tresco tried to assassinate Hitler by smuggling 2 bottles of Cointreau with bombs inside to his plane in Russia. Olbricht, the other key figure, the commander of the reserve, the chief of staff of the reserve army, gathered forces in order to occupy the command centers in Berlin as soon as Hitler will be assassinated. So this was the plan. First, create chaos, no center to the regime. Then occupy Berlin. Then try to convince the generals to join. It will be much easier for them because they may drift to support the people who control the center of government. But the attempt failed because of a malfunction of the bomb. And it was not carried out in 1934, several attempts to assassinate Hitler by suicide bombers failed as well. They tried three or four times. In every case, the suicide bomber was not able to approach Hitler. The new supreme commander of the resistance, civilian commander, from around 38-40, was General Ludwig Beck. He was the chief of staff in 38, resigned because he could not support war over the Sudeten crisis, and became more and more critical of the regime with time. He became the leader of the resistance in around 39 or 40. The reason was that these young officers, who were not known, even in the army, many of them, had to add a kind of a father figure, a famous person who could be the head of state after the revolt. Beck was also very good at mediating between different groups in the resistance. There were a lot of internal debates. So he was a unifying figure, but he was also a weak supreme commander and tended to bend according to the will of the young officers who are not dominant in the military wing. That's why in 32 he gave his permission to, in 42, sorry, he gave his permission to assassinate Hitler. Stauffenberg, the famous assassin, which is played by Tom Cruise in the new movie, the one with the eye patch, was a very eccentric person, very dynamic officer, with a crazy charisma. As one reads his biographies, one can see that he had a very Hitler-style charisma. He could magnetize people in a conversation. So his style of leadership was very different. Instead of Oster style, of trying to create silent alliances with as many people as possible, Stauffenberg did that too, but he collected around himself a group of adherents, of fanatic fans, who were ready to follow him to the coup d'etat and obey his commands no matter what. At the first time, he installed in the resistance a sense of discipline and loyalty, which was very important. Remember our model with the vertical dependencies and the horizontal dependencies? Stauffenberg's way was to minimize horizontal dependencies, again, first to assassinate Hitler and then ask for permission, and to strengthen the vertical dependencies as much as possible. And the new strategy, as we say, I call it a dagger in the heart, to assassinate Hitler first of all. The plan that Stauffenberg devised in order to bring this attempt to success was codenamed Valkyrie. Valkyrie was actually a military plan devised in the high command to put down a rebellion of foreign workers in Berlin. There were many foreign workers, actually foreign slaves, inside the German Reich. They could rebel. There is such a scenario. And the idea was that when foreign workers rebel, the army should occupy the government centers in Berlin. This was confirmed by Hitler personally. Stauffenberg used it as a cover for the coup d'etat. After Hitler will be assassinated, of course there is a danger that foreign workers will take over Berlin. Therefore, the army has to occupy the command centers. And the idea was that only after the revolt, then the leader, the civilian leaders of the resistance, will broadcast to the nation speaking about the crimes of Hitler, his military folly, to convince the nation that they did the right thing, but this will be only after the coup, not before. But Stauffenberg encountered some problems. First of all, his plan called Operation Seagull, that he devised along with Tresco, to occupy Hitler's headquarters after the assassination by troops. This, the document of his plan was discovered only recently in Soviet archives. Was a very sophisticated plan, very useful one. The problem was that the Nazis saw the conspirators digging. They wanted to hide. They hid the plan in the ground. Some Nazi officers saw them doing it. And therefore, this plan was neutralized. They had to hide all the documents and the explosives which were used for the operation in Eastern Prussia. Now, there are some problems with the assassination, like what happened in 1933. The suicide bombers who couldn't get access to Hitler. Many things can happen. Therefore, the conspirators were very much prepared for an option that the assassination attempt will not take place. Therefore, the plan was, we hide everything, keep our head low for some time, then try again. There was a second option, that the plan will be carried out and succeed, that Hitler will die. And this was just Operation Valkyrie. But there was a third option, which the conspirators didn't think about. What will happen if the bomb will explode and Hitler will not die? If the bomb explodes, it means that we have to carry out the plan, because we will be arrested. But on the other hand, Hitler is not dead. And then some of the problems in Stauffenberg's plan were evident. First of all, in order to sign Operation Valkyrie, he had to get the signature of his commander, General Fromm, commander-in-chief of the Reserve Army, who was not a conspirator. General Fromm probably agreed to cooperate with the plan if Hitler will die. But again, horizontal alliance. Second thing, and more important, the commanders-in-chief in the commander-in-chief in the West, General Kluge, according to the plan, should surrender to the Americans when the coup will succeed, in order to free the army in the West to come to help Berlin. Again, Kluge agreed to cooperate if Hitler will die. Another horizontal alliance. So, and the officer who should have taken control of Berlin in behalf of the conspirators, Major Remmer, was not a conspirator, didn't know anything about the plan. Stauffenberg believed Remmer, this major, is a vertical ally. We are generals, he's a major, he will obey our commands. But things were more problematic in reality. Just to say something about that, some civilians in the resistance believed that it would be possible to convince the German people that the regime was horrible, and then the people will come and help the conspirators. Stauffenberg believed more in military tribunals, just to shoot the leaders of the regime as soon as possible. So this is actually a map of what happened in Europe in the day of 20th July 1944. Stauffenberg put the bomb in Hitler's headquarters. It was during a military conference. The bomb exploded, but Hitler didn't die. Stauffenberg believed that Hitler is dead. He flew to Berlin from Eastern Prussia. It took him 4 hours. As he was the military leader of the conspiracy, the conspirators in Berlin waited for him to return before activating Operation Valkyrie. Therefore, they lost critical 4 hours. After Stauffenberg returned, they called all officers loyal to the resistance around the Nazi Empire and tried to convince them, according to Operation Valkyrie, to arrest the SS people, the ministers and government officials, and take control of the areas in behalf of the conspiracy. So the high command of the conspiracy is here in Berlin. They had officers loyal to them in Eastern Prussia. One of his officers was the commander of the German Signal Corps, and his responsibility was to cut communications from Hitler's headquarters in Eastern Prussia, so the Nazi leaders will not be able to give commands. So only the conspirators will control the military channels of communication. He did it, but he was able to do it only for 2 hours before he was arrested. But Stauffenberg, it took him 4 hours to return to Berlin. So this advantage was nullified. Another center, two centers of the conspirators are in France and Belgium, and a third one in Vienna. The center in Belgium was nullified, was neutralized a few days before 20th July 44 because the commander was replaced. Now we have mainly France and Vienna. After Stauffenberg came back to Berlin, bit by bit he understood that Hitler is alive. He tried to lie to the commanders around the Reich and to tell that Hitler is dead. More and more, they stopped to believe him. Therefore, even some of the conspirators started to desert. Mainly, the horizontal alliances collapsed. Stauffenberg's commander, General Fromm, did not agree to cooperate, did not agree to sign the commands. He was arrested by the conspirators. So they were able to overcome the loss of one horizontal ally by neutralizing him. Now, what happened in France? In France, the conspirators had the ideal conditions. The military governor of France, General von Stülpnagel, was a conspirator. He was privy to the plan. That is, according to our definitions, a vertical ally. And he had the military power in France. So what he did was to arrest a few thousand SS soldiers and officers. And he called Berlin. He told them that the loyalty of France is to the conspiracy, to the coup. What was the problem? That Stülpnagel could arrest SS people. He had the forces in Paris. He couldn't surrender to the Allies. The only person who could do it was Field Marshal von Kluge, the commander-in-chief of the Western Front. Again, he agreed to cooperate if Hitler will die. And this horizontal ally collapsed as well. Kluge did not agree to cooperate and commanded Stülpnagel to free the arrested SS personnel. Nevertheless, because in France the conspiracy had many vertical allies, France actually held more than Germany. So the center of the conspiracy in France surrendered about 2 or 3 hours after the headquarters in Berlin was occupied. Vienna as well, the officers in Vienna deserted when they heard that Hitler is alive around 8 in the evening. Okay, so now for our analysis of what happened in this day. Again, unforeseen developments, an unplanned scenario. The conspirators planned 2 options. They didn't plan the third, that the bomb will explode and Hitler will survive. This failure was fatal. Therefore, they were dependent on unreliable people. We spoke about 2 horizontal allies before, Kluge and Fromm, which should have cooperated in Berlin and in the West, and stopped to cooperate when they learned that Hitler is alive. But even worse than that, Major Remmer, the young officer in Berlin, who should have carried out the revolt inside Berlin, was actually a Nazi officer. Stauffenberg believed that he will be a vertical ally because he is a young officer and he will obey commands. He obeyed commands for a while. He went to arrest Goebbels in the most dramatic scene in Berlin in 20th July 44, the propaganda minister. Goebbels did not lose his composure. He just called Hitler and gave the phone to Remmer. And then when Hitler gave commands to Remmer, of course, Remmer immediately changed to the Nazi side. By the way, after the war, he became a major neo-Nazi leader in Germany and surrounded the headquarters of the conspiracy. So even a person which Stauffenberg believed is a vertical ally, someone who obeys commands, turned into an enemy when these unforeseen developments happened. Now, the conspiracy had a problem that inside the inner circle of the conspirators, the vertical allies, you had mostly staff officers. And this was disastrous because a staff officer in the German army cannot do anything unusual without the signature and permission of his commander-in-chief. what we call organic commanders, meaning commanders of divisions, commanders of armies, commander-in-chief in the West, people who can order troops. It is not a chance that the only organic commander that the conspirators had, the military governor of France, von Stülpnagel, was the only one who was able to have a real achievement in 20th July 44. And that was the main difference from 38. In 38, the conspirators were dependent on two horizontal allies. On the other end, they had organic commanders. So if other permission would have been given, then it would have been no problem to use troops to occupy Berlin, because the commander of Greater Berlin, the commander of Thuringen, division commander, supported the conspirators. This was not the case in 44. A staff officer is nothing when his commander-in-chief does not cooperate. And what happened in 20th July 44 again and again in the different cities around the Reich, that the conspirators had many vertical allies, staff officers, in all sorts of cities, but their commanders did not belong to the conspiracy. So even when allies of the conspiracy wanted to carry out their job, they couldn't, because they were only staff officers. And now I'm coming to a crucial point. Remember what I called before the myth of dilettantism? That the conspirators failed because we were dilettantes? One historian again asked, how such experienced officers could do such mistakes? No, they were too experienced. They were just experienced in something else. They were experienced in staff work. They were experienced in conventional war. That is a chain of command, written orders. They were not experienced in making coup d'etats. And I want to give you one example. When Stauffenberg sent his commands to the various towns, he had to be very quick in order to do it before Hitler. His staff officer, a very loyal person, a young officer, went with the commands in order to send them, to dispatch them. The technician asked him, okay, are these commands secret? So he said, okay, of course, they are top secret. This is a normal military law. When you send such important commands, of course, they are top secret. Only that in order to send top secret documents, you have to wait 4 hours. A conspirator has to act quickly. He doesn't have to send top secret documents and to be engaged in military bureaucracy. So here we see an officer who did just what an officer is supposed to do, and that's why he failed. Again, not planning unforeseen scenarios, being dependent on written commands, which takes a long time for them to be sent. This was the conspirators' military thinking, and in the end, it doomed them. So these are the oaths of professionalism. The whole ethos of the German high command, of having highly professional officers, highly educated, people will know what to do according to a certain set of rules in certain circumstances, was deadly for the conspiracy. Stauffenberg was able to overcome it in a while. Oster before him too. That's why Stauffenberg could go and speak with officers which were not related to him, use his personal charisma in order to circumvent the normal chain of command. But still, in the hour of truth, when the moment came to be spontaneous, he too, and the others even more, were bound by the normal chain of command and by the ethos of professionalism. Keeping initiative is critical in coup d'etats. One of the problems in 20th July 44, that the conspirators did not have initiative themselves. For example, we mentioned Major Remmer. Why couldn't one of the conspiracy leaders, a general, go with him personally and make sure that he obeys the commands? A general who was part of the conspiracy could have shot Goebbels, for example, and not giving permission to use the phone. again, they were dependent on other people. They didn't take the initiative enough themselves. Understanding mass media is something which was critical too. In a modern country, occupying the centers of mass communication is critical. Because when you control the radio, when you control the TV, was not yet, but radio mainly, when you control the radio, you're the boss. You have the power. You broadcast to the people. Hitler used the radio in order to broadcast again and again, Goebbels did it, that the Führer is alive, the attempt failed. When officers around the Reich heard it in the radio, nothing that Stauffenberg could tell them on the phone could convince them. This is part of modernity. You believe more what you hear in the media than what someone tells you in a phone call. Stauffenberg told Hitler is dead, the radio told that Hitler is alive, and everyone believed the radio. The conspirators were not quick enough in taking over the radio stations. Instead, they preferred to occupy the main military base in Berlin. This is, again, old-style thinking. You occupy a city, you should occupy the main military base. No, the radio was more important. And this was, in a certain respect, a coup that failed because of the failure to understand the importance of mass media. And, of course, the thing that plagued them for 38 to 44, unreliable horizontal allies. And did they have a chance? Yeah, they had. But they had also structural problems which minimized the chance, not to zero, but in a very substantial way. And I want to conclude with perhaps the best insight on the conspiracy that I've ever read, written by Professor Peter Hoffman, perhaps the most prominent historian of the conspiracy, that taking all of his problems into account, the best time to resist totalitarian regimes is before they come to power. Thank you. Yeah.
We've heard from many sources that that Himmler was growing, was increasingly of the view that Germany was going to lose the war, was increasingly disaffected with Hitler's wartime leadership from at least early 44 on, maybe even late 43. There are also reports, I can't cite the sources at the moment, that Himmler may have known about the July plot and let it proceed because he was not at all averse to seeing Hitler removed in terms of what you're suggesting, the power struggle among the top Nazi leadership.
Himmler, one of the conspirators, a marginal figure, a lawyer named Langben, was the most, let's say, close to the Nazis person in the conspiracy. An extreme right-wing fascist. And he was marginalized more and more because of it as time went by. His daughter asked him somewhere in 41 if she can visit a friend of hers for a weekend. He asked what's the name of her friend. It was Himmler. It was Himmler's daughter. So he tried to use this opportunity to come and pick up his daughter and speak with Himmler. And he told Himmler all about the conspiracy in an attempt to get him to cooperate. Himmler listened very politely. He didn't arrest him. He could have arrested him immediately. He didn't do so. There are two options. Either Himmler wanted to use the conspirators in order to make them topple Hitler and take power himself afterwards. There was no chance for a real cooperation between the conspirators and Hitler. When the other conspirators heard about Langben's initiative, they ostracized him virtually immediately. Because Himmler, for them, some of them, until 41 or 42, were willing to cooperate with Göring, which was considered as a kind of a moderate by some people. But with Himmler, never. Like Himmler, even for people who may have supported Hitler, some of them didn't like Himmler. He was the symbol of everything which is evil with the regime, for everyone was critical. The other option, which sounds more likely to me, is that Himmler wanted to follow them, to see how they grow, and then to destroy all the network in one stroke. This is what we did to the communists in around 36, 35. Again, we don't know for sure. What we do know, that Himmler did not know about Stauffenberg, nor about the other military leaders, because Stauffenberg took pains to tell his secret only to other officers. He was certain that because of the officer corps internal loyalty, even if his officers will not agree to cooperate, we will not denounce him, which was true, surprisingly. On the other hand, the civilian leaders of the conspiracy, if you read, von Hassel was the kind of the foreign minister of the conspiracy. You can read his diary, which was one of the best sources for the conspiracy. Always you come by to a sentence like this. I dined in this restaurant with the Duchess X, and we spoke about how much Hitler is horrible and how much he should be toppled immediately. He just spoke, they spoke all the time. And Himmler was following all of the civilian leaders, not the military leaders. Therefore, I think that Himmler was genuinely surprised after 20th July. And last thing, Himmler told someone, there is one testimony, that I know the traitors, I'm following them, I need to have the last piece of the puzzle, and then I will eliminate them all. If it is true, you know, we shouldn't trust every testimony, but if it is true, the last piece was Stauffenberg. Thanks a lot.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Harvard University PhD candidate Danny Orbach. Mr. Orbach's lecture was titled The Anti-Nazi Coups That Failed, 1938 and 1944, Did They Have a Chance? And was presented by the Boston University International History Institute in the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Professor William Kalor, director of the International History Institute. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mark Liam Bruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.